Arguably the most important American lawyer of the 20th century, Thurgood Marshall, was on the verge of bringing the landmark suit Brown versus Board of Education before the U.S. Supreme Court when he became embroiled in an explosive and deadly case that threatened to change the course of the civil rights movement and cost him his life. In 1949, Florida's orange industry was booming. The citrus barons got rich on the backs of cheap Jim Crow labor. To maintain order and profits, they turned to Willis McCall, a violent sheriff who ruled Lake County with murderous resolve. When a white 17-year-old Groveland girl cried rape, McCall was fast on the trail of four young blacks who dared to envision a future for themselves beyond the citrus groves. By day's end, the KKK had rolled into town, burning the homes of blacks to the ground and chasing hundreds into the swamps, hell-bent on lynching the young men who came to be known as the Groveland Boys. The story is told in journalist Gilbert King's excellent Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, the Groveland Boys, and the Dawn of a New America. Gilbert King, it's a great pleasure to have you before our microphones and to have you in the studio with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Joe.
As I mentioned earlier in the program, this is my cruise ship reading.
Right.
And I know this may shock you. I hope it doesn't, but this may shock you. I was the only one on board that I could see that was reading this book.
Okay. A little bit
so
shocked.
That's a growth opportunity for you.
I guess. Yeah. Where was the cruise, I guess?
It was just the Caribbean, but you okay. know. My God, what a book. How did you come across this story to a point where you say, there are so many facets and this is something that I can really dig my heels into?
Right. Well, I think while I was working on my last book, which is a, it was sort of an NAACP story about an execution that had gone wrong in the South, and Thurgood Marshall sort of got involved in that, and I was kind of overwhelmed by how sophisticated he was in terms of looking at beyond the law, but looking at the media and how they could bring clergy and movie stars, and this is 1940s, how they could rally public support in, you know, behind the scenes and through the media to sort of help save a kid's life. And I started reading some more about some of these things he did sort of outside the courts, and this case popped up, and I just couldn't believe some of the things that I'd never heard of. And, you know, this was a huge case at the time, and it's just completely forgotten.
The clarity he seemed to have had of what the impacts could be is what really impressed me.
Right. I mean, I think he was very sophisticated about this. Now, you know, a lot of times people thought that, oh, he just used the law to change things. He wasn't about the public hearts and minds, but he really saw the big picture. He was out there, you know, he felt like when he showed up on one of these Jim Crow courtrooms, he was putting on a performance of what could be for the people who packed those balconies to see him, whites and blacks. And they would see Thurgood Marshall practicing law, and they really didn't object to it. Even whites would sometimes join the NAACP in sort of protesting against police brutality. And so he had this impact on the community and on the whole country as a large, just through getting involved in these criminal cases.
So bring us to this point in 1949 of how this case comes about and ultimately how he gets involved.
Right. Well, you know, back then there was really the law enforcement was sort of stacked against blacks at the time. And so when these cases would pop up, there was really nobody else to turn to except the NAACP. And the NAACP had more than enough cases to choose from. But this one really caught their attention because they believed right off the bat that these guys were innocent of rape and that this was just being a sort of a whitewashing, sort of a rush to, and they were gonna execute these guys within a month probably of the trial. And so Marshall got involved, and his first thing was just, we got to put on a defense and just sort of start the process of defending these men in court, which was always a difficult thing in the South because you had like 12 white jurors, a prosecutor, and heavy involvement in the Klan. And so they knew they weren't going to win these cases, but they would at least start the appellate process through a trial.
And through the start of that process, again, he had a lot of foresight in how the process would work.
Right. I think that was one of the things that, you know, and there was sort of this battle of the minds. A lot of times he would go into these cases and you know, he'd be up against a white prosecutor who just had no respect for a black attorney who was defending black clients and sort of figured, oh, I can run rings around these guys in court. Watch me. But Marshall and his attorneys would sit back and say, these guys are making every mistake in the book. And when we take this to a higher court like the Supreme Court, that's an actual level playing field where you have, you know, really the best and the brightest legal minds on the Supreme Court. And they'll look at the law and they'll see all these mistakes and they'll throw this jury trial right out. And so he sort of recognized that he might not win those criminal trials in these home counties, but he could, if they made mistakes and they did things that weren't according to the Constitution, he would get them thrown out. So that was his advantage that he had.
He wants to go into this. He wants to work this case, and his associates are saying, don't do this. This is suicide. Don't do this.
Right. And this is really the shocking part of the book, because Brown versus Board is just starting to get off the ground here. He's like really imperative to the whole civil rights movement at this stage. You know, he's become famous. He's become known as Mr. Civil Rights. And they're starting to get some momentum on these civil rights cases, on segregation. They've already won some voting rights cases. Things are starting to change in America. And then Marshall wants to go down and defend these four gentlemen from rape charges. And his associates are saying, Thurgood, we need you. This is too dangerous. You know, they're killing people down there, which was true. That, you know, there were four people were killed in the middle of this trial. One of his friends with the NAACP was killed in mid-trial, and it was just very dangerous. They called it the Florida Terror. There were bombs exploding everywhere for a year during this trial, and it was a very dangerous place. He was threatened many times. A governor's assistant came to him and said, your life is in danger. One of the deputies is after you. And you know, he was terrified. He was terrified, but he also realized he couldn't stop. He had to do this.
Well, it does seem like it made him work even harder to dig in his heels and to become more persistent.
I think so. I think it was just one of those things where he felt the responsibility of these communities that just felt they had nowhere else to turn. They weren't going to get it from law enforcement. The FBI was not going to help them. There was really nowhere else to go except the NAACP. And I think when he came into these communities, he realized, you know, that he was their only hope. And they would put him in houses, change houses at night, move him around so that the Klan wouldn't get him. And it was frightening for him. And like I said, he's seeing his friends and people he knows die. The defendants are getting killed in this case, in the middle of the case. And he sees all this danger around him, but he just can't stop himself. Once this thing starts, he really feels like he has to see it through to the end. And he never quit on it.
When you look at the case and its impact, of course, what really helped you were a lot of the files that had opened up and also the NAACP's files that you had access to.
Right. That was a big help because, you know, I filed a Freedom of Information Act a couple of years ago, but the files were so extensive that they told me there's going to be a long wait to see these because they don't have an endless staff that can just go through and clear these files. But I got fortunate in the middle of my research that 60 years is the cutoff. And as soon as something reaches 60 years, it all gets released. And so in the middle of this, they just called me one day and said, it's all public. So I went down the next day and there were just, and the thing that was fascinating about this stuff, Joe, is that, you know, you have stacks of files that were FBI interviews. And a lot of times the police would give statements and the sheriff departments would give statements and they're very guarded in their statements, but they would pull the FBI agents off to the side and say, I'll tell you what happened, but I can't say this officially. And all those moments are documented in the notes and all the names are there. None of them are blacked out. So it really gave me this insight. Like I could really figure out what happened in this case. And the same thing with the LDF files. The NAACP had these files that were sealed and really nobody gets to see these. It was just a matter of persistence and luck that I got a hold of them. And it was the same thing. It's like being a fly sort of inside the conference room where you're going over their strategies and all the minutes are recorded so you could see what they were up against.
What did it give you insight into Thurgood Marshall? Because it's one of those chicken and egg things. You know, did this help form who he became as a Supreme Court justice, or is what we saw, you know, the result of so much? Because he's such an incredible figure, and you see all of the ingredients there working on this case in 1949.
Right. You know, I think a lot of these cases that he got involved in sort of made a really big impact on his life. I think he went to law school thinking, you know, it's a middle class existence. Maybe I can just get ahead. He hung out a shingle. He was doing private law. And then this opportunity came along to sort of tour the South and see what was out there with his mentor, with Charles Hamilton Houston. Mm. And he did a couple road trips down South and he started to see the conditions of the schools and how it wasn't, you know, separate but equal, that you know, the places he visited with Houston, it was just dilapidated. There was no funding. And that sort of made an impact on him. And I think also getting these letters, you know, he would get these horrible letters from families down South where they're, you know, their teen daughters had been raped by like powerful white men in the communities and nothing would happen or they'd get a $100 fine. And then you know, the same thing, exact thing would happen where, and they couldn't get involved in those because they weren't a defense, or they weren't a, they couldn't force prosecution. But sometimes they would get letters saying, you know, our town is being burned down. These men have been accused of rape, which is what happened in this Groveland case. And in those cases, he could defend, and he'd go down there. And he, I think he just got caught up in what he perceived as, you know, unequal justice in the courts.
We have a few minutes left, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on, as you've been going around and talking about this book, a lot of connections have been made to the Trayvon Martin case in Florida. And if, I mean, your book takes place in 1949, and here we are in 2012, and you say to yourself, well, you know, where have we really gone?
Right.
Do you think it's a fair comparison?
I think it is. You know, one of the things, and I was down in Florida and Sanford just last week talking to people about this, you know, who, you know, feel directly affected by this. And they asked a very similar question. And I think main thing I try to stress is that in 1949, or even earlier, when Thurgood Marshall was down in that same area fighting these, you know, same type of shootings, that nothing would happen, you really couldn't get a police chief to step down. You couldn't apply the kind of pressure that you see nowadays. Nowadays, you know, after the Trayvon Martin shooting, you had a Sanford police chief temporarily resign. You had the FBI and the Department of Justice say, we promise we'll look into this right away, and they sprung into action. When Marshall was working these cases in the 40s, basically, they said, do not even protest down here. They will kill you. Do not even gather in groups. The sheriff is not going to do anything. And this was just ignored. Governors didn't want anything to do with civil rights crimes. They just were perceived as, you know, insignificant because they weren't voting. Sheriffs didn't want to, you know, really bother with it at all. It was just one of those things that nobody cared about, and it was off the radar. But nowadays, you see that through Marshall and through a lot of activists that you know, there is attention. These things are not brushed under. And you see in Trayvon Martin, like, you know, there's a grand jury, or there's going to be charges filed. Charges were filed.
But that
filed.
Took almost a month.
It took a month, but I think—
It took a month in the New York Times.
Right. Well, yeah, that's true. I think what did happen is, I think Sanford's police department probably did do it the way they used to do things back then, and they just sort of said, "Oh, we'll handle this." It was a stand your ground kind of thing, and there was that hesitation. But the public pressure really just didn't have that back then, and this time I think it made a big difference.
I think it's impossible to read this book and not come out with just tremendous respect for Thurgood Marshall.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely did too. One of the things I found is I went through there, and I had access to so many of his files, and it was interesting. You know, there's certain things I did find about it. He definitely liked to drink, and he was definitely known as sort of a womanizer, but you know, I couldn't find one single instance of like an ethical lapse or anything where he didn't really feel like we have to do the right thing. And sometimes he stood up to everybody in the NAACP and said, no, we have to do this. This is the right thing. Even when there was pressure not to do that. And I think every time I looked at him, I kept looking for those one little moment where he was looking for a shortcut or a quick solution to
contradiction
things.
Contradiction of some type.
I never found it. That was what was fascinating to me, because I really looked for it. I wanted it to be interesting. But he really was almost saintly in the way he perceived the law. He really just had high regard and high ethical values that he set on himself.
The book is such a page turner. It's really an incredible story, and it's called The Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall and the Groveland Boys and the Dawn of a New America. It is published by Harper. You're from Schenectady.
I'm a Schenectady, Niskayuna boy.
Excellent. Well, it's good to have you home, and I thank you so much for dropping by and telling us about the book.
Really thank you
appreciate
very much.
It. Gilbert King's book is Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys, and The Dawn of a New America. It's published by Harper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.